I have a lot of family, a lot of people that I know of in Iran, and I am worried about every single of them.
The war in the Middle East has left people at UNC feeling the weight of the conflict. Welcome to Carolina Connection. I'm Raina Drake.
And I'm Andrew Sellers. Also this week, experts say rising gas prices are closely related to the conflict in the Middle East. Fourth District Congresswoman Valerie Fouché's slim victory highlights tensions in the Democratic Party, and students explore the power of printmaking as political expression.
You know, making yourself vulnerable as an artist is probably the most connecting thing you can do with a stranger.
From the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media, this is Carolina Connection.
Thanks for joining us. Fourth District Congresswoman Valerie Fouché is likely headed back to Washington for her third term. But that next term may be influenced by a primary election this week she barely won. At least, that's what NIDA alum's supporters hope. The challenger, who ran an anti-establishment campaign, says the close race signals the Democratic Party needs to change. When alum supporters gathered at a downtown Durham election night watch party, they hoped to be celebrating an upset victory. Alum challenged two-term incumbent Valerie Fouché in the Democratic primary, and at the end of the night, the race was close.
So though we go to bed tonight without the full results, we will keep exercising our right to dream, and we will bring home a victory for the working families of North Carolina in the days ahead. Thank you.
But Alum did not bring home a victory this time. Fouché won the Democratic primary by less than 1 percentage point. Fouché wasn't available for an interview, but said in a statement she looks forward to continuing the fight to, in her words, deliver progressive change. That message of change was key to an alum campaign that said the Democratic Party has no future against Republicans if it continues to be a revolving door for corporate interests and billionaire donors.
Because corporate donors may outspend us, but they can never outsmart or outwork everyday working families.
Mike Lee, chair of the Durham County Board of Commissioners, was at the watch party. As a commissioner, he's seen Vice Chair Alum in action. He spoke to me before the final results came in.
I think NIDA has raised some really good concerns about campaign finances and even with like ICE. So she's already pushed the party in a direction that it needs to go. I hope she wins, but if not, she's already made her mark.
Sarah Truel Roberts, a UNC political science professor, says there is some truth in the idea that voters want a change in the Democratic Party. However, she says the smaller number of voters who participate in primaries don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the majority.
One thing that does help a candidate like Alum, a more progressive candidate on the left, is that the people that do tend to turn out in primaries tend to be a little bit more extreme. Now, the people that stay at home are more likely the people that are, oh, let's keep the status quo. Oh, let's look for a moderate. And so it's hard to say that that's the overwhelming sort of call for change in Congress that's coming from this.
But Truel Roberts says the closeness of the race will likely carry some weight in Fouché's next term.
I do think that this race got Fouché's attention, right? And I think if you are Alum or you are an Alum supporter, I think you can be heartened by the fact that there was great progressive turnout and there was interest in this election. And I do think it signals to the current incumbent, Valerie Fouché, that there is interest in the issues that Alum brought up and that Fouché needs to pay attention to them.
The general election for North Carolina's 4th Congressional District will take place this November. Fouché is challenged by Republican Max Gonikar. In the deeply Democratic district, Truel Roberts says it is almost certain Fouché will win.
In Chapel Hill, Iranian Americans are worrying about the safety of their loved ones. Yesterday, President Trump announced he would not accept anything less than Iran's unconditional surrender in the rapidly expanding war. And Israeli officials said they struck an underground bunker in Tehran that belonged to late Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. Rachel Moody has more on the local reaction.
Nazanin Kratzen is an Iranian-American filmmaker and UNC professor. She moved to the U.S. in 2003, but her family remained in Tehran, where she grew up.
I also heard from one of my aunts, and she left me a very short message saying that Don't worry, my house is not over near any government building, anything related to army, so we are okay, but we are staying put.
International communication and internet access in Iran has been limited since the strikes on Saturday.
Don't worry, usually it's what people say. So I won't quite trust, not in a bad way, but I know that when they say don't worry, we are okay, it's not necessarily the entire story. But we also know, they know there's not much we can do, we cannot go. Like when my dad passed away, one of the first things that my uncle said was, please don't come to Iran right now because there's the threat of war and you can get stuck.
Kritzen says geographical, financial, and gas supply challenges during the 12-day war last June made it difficult for residents to leave Tehran. The United Nations Refugee Agency estimated around 100,000 people left the city in the 2 days after the initial attack. She says it's not as easy as dropping everything and leaving.
The people that I know that I went to college with, that are my family, friends, relatives, majority of them, they want that government to change. But then there is so much difference of opinion between how that change needs to happen, or even if it's going to change, is it worth bombing and killing these many innocent people?
Navin Bappan, the chair of UNC's Department of Political Science, says the Trump administration's objectives with the war have been unclear.
Again, the first articulated objective was to change the regime. I think several Trump administration officials have not indicated that that's true anymore. For the U.S., the aim seems to be on disarming Iran, which is destroying all their capability, their air assets, their sea assets, anything that could be used to potentially produce a nuclear weapon.
Bappan says he doesn't believe there will be direct violence in the U.S. However, many Americans have family in the region or in the military who may be directly affected. As dozens of people covered UNC's quad Friday, Sally Rahimi joined a bake sale for UNC Students for Justice in Palestine.
I have a lot of family, a lot of friends, a lot of peers, a lot of people that I know of, a lot of activists, a lot of journalists, and lots of political figures in Iran that are against the regime inside of the Iran, and I am worried about every single of them.
Rahimi is an Iranian-American feminist activist who immigrated to the U.S. in 2013. She says she can talk to her loved ones only briefly.
And they say, hey, we are alive. As you know, inside is also a very dangerous situation. They cannot talk about what is happening. We cannot get accurate information through conversation via phone.
President Trump said the conflict is projected to last 4 to 5 weeks, but has the capability to go far longer than that. Bappan, the chair of the Political Science Department, says there's little clarity.
This is really going to be a question of how long the United States and Israel want to pursue this violence in Iran and how long it can last and what the objectives are.
He says he hopes to see strategic objectives emerge in the coming days. In Chapel Hill, I'm Rachel Moody.
In the days following the initial strike on Tehran, gas prices across North Carolina climbed by about 20 cents. To understand why, I spoke with Matthew Metzger, a clinical professor of economics at UNC Charlotte. Professor Metzger, thanks for joining us.
Okay, yeah, great.
To start, how does the war going on in the Middle East affect the economy here in North Carolina?
Yeah, you know, it's had a dramatic impact on gas prices, you know, almost immediately. It was surprising even to me how quickly it shot up. But the issue is, next to Iran, you have the Strait of Hormuz, and about 20% of the global oil supply goes through that strait. And now if you have conflict going on around it and bombings and flights overhead and everything, and there's lots of unknowns, it's just a tremendous risk whether you want to send oil through there.
A lot of people are curious about these gas prices. Realistically, how significant of an increase will we see?
The prices, you know, as far as gasoline prices, you know, they went up around 20, 22 cents, you know, within the state and also here in Charlotte, just in a few day period. And, you know, gas prices were already kind of trending up because in the spring, the summer, more people are traveling, demand goes up. You typically see prices rise. So it was kind of already headed up that way anyways. And then we had this conflict with the risk, and then it just added, you know, 20, 22 cents right on top of it. And of course, you know, it's not a great time because inflation's kind of, you know, over the last, since COVID really, has spiked up quite a bit. And so some of those prices never came back down.
That actually leads me into my next question. Beyond gas prices, what are other things that can be affected by this war that people may not be aware of?
I mean, one thing I would say jumps out right away to me is that if the price of gas goes up to, say, $3.25, $3.50, how will that affect summer travel, you know, vacations, Memorial Day, things like that. And then often what you see too, when gas prices rise, consumers sometimes shift away from those like gas guzzling type of vehicles, you know, bigger SUVs and things like that, and might try to switch to more, you know, fuel efficient vehicles or even electric vehicles. Who knows? It's hard to tell, but there's definitely effects when the price of gas goes up that people buying vehicles make adjustments knowing that they're going to have to pay more in fuel.
So moving forward, what can we expect in the next few months?
Well, I would say, unfortunately, gas prices are not likely to come back down because historically, when you look at data, you know, if there's a risk or instability, those prices, businesses push those prices up, but they don't come back down as quickly. Businesses tend to wait a much longer period to really see, are things stable or not? And so certainly in this type of situation, things are not going to be stable for quite some time. Definitely not over the next, you know, month or two while the operations are ongoing. And then even after that, for quite a while, it's going to be a question mark, you know, which way Iran's going to go with its transition. We have no idea what it's going to turn into.
That was Professor Matthew Metzger from UNC Charlotte. Professor, thanks for joining us.
All right. Have a good day.
You're listening to Carolina Connection, the weekly student newscast from UNC's Hussman School of Journalism and Media. I'm Andrew Sellers.
And I'm Raina Drake. A controversial Durham artist known for confronting racial and political injustices brought his work to UNC last week. Raj Banug led hands-on printmaking events showing how art can spark reflection on social and political issues, even in a climate of institutional pressure. Javon Hun reports.
You know, it's the personality of the chef. It's like you see all the little doodads on it, all the things, little tchotchkes and stuff, you know, it's like.
Yeah, so super. Inside the Graduate Student Center at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the sounds of carving tools scratching linoleum fills the room. Students lean over tables, pressing into ink-carved blocks, learning how printmaking has long been tied to social and political movements. For Raj Banug, political art started more than a decade ago.
The Occupy movement was really going strong, really making just making work that had meaning and was trying to promote, you know, something other than just being, you know, a cool print.
Banug, a Thai American artist based in Durham, is known for his large linocut prints that confront racial and political injustice, drawing from history as well as current events. Banug says the North Carolina Museum of Art declined to include one of his prints in a 2025 exhibition due to concerns about overt political criticism. Patrick Bond, U.S. Program Officer with the Artists at Risk Connection, says situations like that reflect a broader tension institutions are navigating.
When institutions feel like they need to act individually, they are feeling vulnerable from political pressure, and then what often happens is that pressure then gets displaced onto individual artists and cultural workers who are not as equipped, don't have as many resources to be able to deal with the ramifications of the censorship.
Bond says some artists are already adjusting their work because of that pressure.
But also, there's a shocking number of folks who were expected, who changed or canceled work just of their own volition due to the risks that they perceived.
Last Thursday, UNC's Asian American Center invited Banug to a campus for a full day of events, including a faculty, staff, and breakfast, an afternoon artist talk, and the evening printmaking demonstration. One of the works he displayed depicted a life-size immigration agent, defaced with a vulgar comment.
My current work is dealing with the traditions of violence found within systemic white supremacy, like anti-ICE stuff, anti-immigration stuff, because, you know, that affects me directly. You know, my parents are immigrants.
When people encounter his work, Banug says discomfort is part of the point.
I'm making the viewer see themselves in this struggle. Putting this historic violence on display in spaces kept safe by this violence.
Banach says the visual language of his work draws heavily from Southeast Asian traditions.
I mean, a lot of the issue or visuals that I'm dealing with are, and the images I'm creating, you know, are very much inspired by Southeast Asian and specifically Thai Buddhist temple murals. The way the mural moves you as a viewer throughout the temple and through the walls, you know, it's an active viewing experience.
His prints are intentionally dense and overwhelming, designed to hold the viewer's gaze. The themes often draw from contemporary political issues and historical patterns of injustice. Even so, he says vulnerability, not provocation, is what ultimately connects people.
You know, making yourself vulnerable as an artist is probably the most connecting thing you can do with a stranger. When you put your art out there, like, people will see that and will react to it.
At last Thursday's demonstration, the reaction wasn't outrage, it was curiosity. Students lined up to press their own prints, turning a conversation about political unrest into something tangible, carved by hand. In Chapel Hill, I'm Javon Hunt.
Violence prevention isn't always a fun topic, so UNC's Violence Prevention and Advocacy Services is working to make it more interesting. During the inaugural Glow and Know event Thursday, students were able to learn about safety resources on campus. Allison Helms was on the scene.
As students put on impairment goggles, UNC police cheer them on as they try to walk along a blue line on the ground. The impairment goggles simulate being intoxicated, and many students were struggling to walk straight. Police hope it will educate people on the effects of drinking. This was one of many programs tabling at the inaugural Glow and Know Safety After Dark Resource Fair. The fair was organized by VPASS, the Violence Prevention and Advocacy Services program at UNC.
There are tons of resources on campus, but it could be really confusing to know all of them, understand them, feel comfortable pursuing them. And so we're trying to make that a little bit easier, introduce folks to our resources available to them, and also have fun with it.
Kylan Adams is the Prevention Program Specialist at VPASS. Adam says that research shows most people will turn to their friends when experiencing a difficult event.
And so one way that we can all engage in violence prevention is being knowledgeable on the resources so that we're able to help our friends navigate them or make those referrals if possible.
Along with VPASS, other organizations at the fair included Carolina Housing, Student Wellness, and Compass Center, the local domestic violence shelter, and the Chapel Hill Police Department.
We like to come out and talk to individuals because a lot of students live off campus, and so they may interact with us, and you know, we just work together to make sure that they're supported on and off campus regardless.
That's Karina Santibanez, a crisis counselor co-responder with CHPD.
We work very closely with other campus resources. Like, I work very closely with like VPASS or like the Dean of Students office, and we just work to support the student that maybe experienced something off campus.
Santibanez says it can be scary to talk to an officer, so coming out and meeting students can help them feel more comfortable through a reporting process. UNC senior Janae Carter attempted to do the impaired walking test.
I was so confident because I did gymnastics. So I was like, oh, this is like beam, I could do it. And I've done the goggles thing once in like middle school, and they were hyping me up. They're like, oh yeah, you did it. I took the goggles off, I was not on the line.
While free stuff and a CLE credit were definitely enticing, she says she learned about resources too, specifically the UNC Behavioral Assessment and Management Team, which provides a way for people to alert the university if they're concerned about another person's behavior.
If you find someone that's doing something that might have a record, that you can report them, and then they can go to that individual and see what's caused them to do that.
VPASS launched the violence prevention campaign It Takes All Heels and the Hazing Prevention Survey earlier in the school year. Adams is looking forward to continue organizing these events in the future.
But it's always just great to like be out, see people, like be community members, and chat to them like that. It always like warms my heart and makes me feel proud to be a Tar Heel.
She says they try to make violence prevention fun rather than something that feels heavy. In Chapel Hill, I'm Allison Helms. While there were no UNC athletes in the Winter Olympics, there were several who helped document the games in Milan, including one pre-med student who found his own way inside the action as a photographer for the U.S. snowboarding team. Zoe Barrett has more.
Frontside seven, frontside grab, the queen switch.
Nick York is a junior at UNC studying pre-med, but photography has been a passion of his for years. That passion recently took him to Milan, where he photographed Olympic snowboarding events, and he got there completely on his own.
So I cold emailed every single USA, like, specific teams. But I put a little bit extra effort into the snowboarding one, because that's something that I grew up with my dad watching, and they actually got back to me.
York didn't travel with UNC's journalism program or any official media group. Instead, he secured the opportunity himself and attended several snowboarding events during the games. For York, the experience was unreal.
It was a fantastic experience. I mean, again, I grew up, you know, watching the half pipe and stuff, really like all the freestyle snowboarding in general.
25 UNC students who attended the games through the Hussman School of Journalism had a different experience. While they were still able to report on the Olympics, senior Avery Bales says there were still limitations on what they could capture.
A lot of journalism that went into it was more so of like the deeper stories behind what was going on, just because we can't film events and stuff like that because NBC has those rights.
Instead of focusing on competition footage, students had to find unique angles, often highlighting athletes' personal stories or the community surrounding the games in Milan. Senior Carrington Bostic even reported on an athlete who wasn't competing at the games.
I did a story on a woman that competes in Nordic Combine, and that's the one sport where they did not have a women's competition at this Olympic Games, advocating for her right to compete in her sport looking towards the 2030 Games. So I think we navigated it by finding athletes, finding family members, finding stories that were a little more niche, that weren't like necessarily what NBC was reporting on.
Like York, Bale says the experience was unforgettable.
It was absolutely awesome. And I mean, the fans all around, like I met a bunch of people. I was just spectating. It was awesome.
You can hear like the cameras clicking and everything.
But York's experience was unique. He was face to face with the athletes as they competed, including two-time Olympic gold medalist, Chloe Kim.
Well, there'd be many times, like I remember in the preliminary round, Chloe Kim came right above me. And, like, went back down. It was crazy.
Even though York is studying chemistry and psychology at UNC, the Olympic experience inspired him to keep pursuing sports photography.
I mean, I told everyone there, I was like, yeah, like, I'm kind of doing this for my school. Like, I want to come back and share these pictures with as many people, and I want to use it to translate to do photography for my school.
Now back at UNC, York is already reaching out to Carolina Athletics to continue photographing sports closer to home, including women's lacrosse this spring, track and field, and women's volleyball. In Chapel Hill, I'm Zoe Barrett.
On the latest edition of Carolina Connections podcast, Carolina Cast, we hear about new UNC system policies that some faculty worry could limit their rights to academic freedom. Some professors say the policies could even put them in physical danger. Professor Michael Palm objects to a new policy that makes syllabi public records.
Policies like the new policy to publicize syllabuses are that it is making faculty and instructors more susceptible to doxing and to bad faith scrutiny from right-wing ideologues. And so I think the policy is dangerous, and it is a big step in the wrong direction for the UNC system.
Carolina Connection reporter Alice Scott spoke with many other faculty members across the UNC system about this policy and others. You can check out the latest edition of Carolina Cast at carolinaconnection.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
UNC and Duke are clashing for the second time this men's basketball season. Last game, UNC won with a buzzer-beater shot from Seth Trimble in the Dean Dome. Today, the Tar Heels are headed into Blue Devil territory, and Carolina Connection's Lauren Mallett asks students to share their Duke Day traditions.
Ethan Wolkin, sophomore, and I wear my Lucky Game Day sock.
Jackson Kasaya, I'm a freshman, and I just wear all blue and then take a shot and then take another one and then probably a few more and go to the game.
My name is Henry Rauch. I will be borging this weekend, and I'm looking forward to that, and watching the game, and rushing, of course.
I'm Layla Zwetslut, and I'm a sophomore. And my game day tradition is doing some kind of workout or run before the game. I like to shake everything out and, like, feel fully there. We're up on night to get lucky. We're up on
night to get lucky. We're up on night to get lucky. I'm Micah Kennel. I'm a junior. And then my Duke game day tradition, I really like getting with friends, do a whole watch party thing, and then eat like the greasiest food possible. I'm talking like wings and like hot dogs, fries, whole shebang. It's great.
Margaret Klingler. I'm a sophomore and I wear Carolina blue underwear.
My name is Devin Miles Ramsey and I'm a sophomore at UNC. And I think my game day tradition, I normally just put on Carolina gear. I just got a new polo shirt for Christmas that I put on. It really gets me into the game day spirit.
I'm Lucas Niels Wicke. I'm a third year from Switzerland. And if we win against Duke, I would rush Franklin Street like everyone.
And that's the end of this edition of Carolina Connection. We're a production of the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media, and our technical directors are Kevin Paris and Calius Galbraith Fau DeCanto. I'm Andrew Sellers.
And I'm Raina Drake. For more content, you can go to carolinaconnection.org. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, Blue Sky, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now back to weekend programming on 97.9 The Hill.